So I neglected to ask last week who's actually read C.S. Lewis's Four Loves. So a few people have. First chapter and a half. Yeah. I hadn't read it until I embarked on this idea last fall. And so I'm kind of communicating to you my understandings as I've read through it for the first time and listened to his radio broadcast. I did. I did. Didn't anybody else see the commercial? Yeah. So maybe I'll pull that up next week if I think about it, or if we have time today, which is unlikely because I really enjoy the sound of my own voice. So, and then I wanted to remind everybody again that this Saturday at the Byam Theater downtown at 4:00 is going to be C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce. I think it's about a 90-minute performance, and I think there are a few seats left when I looked this morning. Not many, but a few. So I think a few people from the congregation I know are going, just because I know my husband and I are going. So maybe we'll see you there if that's something you're interested in. I made the outline today quite a bit longer. Usually I wouldn't make an outline so long, but since I skipped a lot of stuff last week, I thought it would be nice for, if I happen to skip some things this week, at least you have some semblance of a summary of what he was saying in his chapter on philia, friendship, which is what we're going to be covering today. But before we dive into that, I want to do a little bit of a recap of last week. Last week we started with conversation about the elements of love. So not the four words, Greek words for love, but the elements. Love is a kind of gift that we can give other people. It's sacrificial. Love is also needy. You know, we need the love of our mothers when we're first born. It's also appreciative. Wow, bacon smells really great. And so it can be small, tiny things like that, but it can also be, God, you are so good. Thank you for all of the blessings we have in our life. God, without you, I am nothing. I need you in my life. And also, the gifts that he gives us, that we're able to move through this life with all of his blessings. So it can be on a pretty surface level, like the smell of bacon, or a very, very deep level of God's creation and how wonderful it is to be a part of it. Last week, with talking about storge, we talked a lot more about need love and how the need to be loved and the need to have love in return and to love others in return really is focusing on that element of need that we see in our need for Christ as well. And today we're going to talk a little bit more with philia about appreciative love. But we also talked a little bit about nearness to God and how in our relationship we want to grow closer and closer with him. And fortunately, he created us in his image. So we have some likenesses to him that predispose us to be able to approach him and have a relationship with him. But just because we're like God doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to be on a path where we're approaching him and getting close to him in that relationship. There were also two themes that I introduced. One was the highest cannot stand without the lowest, and how we're asked to align our wills with God's will for us in our lives. And I've got a little quote there. It's under themes. It says, all natural affections can become rivals to spiritual love, but they can also be preparatory imitations of it, training, so to speak, of the spiritual muscles which grace may later put to higher services. So we're going to look at storge last week and how that affection can grow and be more like agape love. This week, we're going to talk about philia. In addition to that, we talked about how love ceases to be a demon only when it ceases to be a god, and love begins to be a demon the moment he begins to be a god. And I took an excerpt from Mere Christianity about God is love, love is God. And I had quite a few interesting conversations with some of you later in the week or just after the lesson about that particular phrase, God is love, but is love is God. It doesn't really work that way, much like an equal sign would imply balance. That's not actually true in that phrase, but many people treat it like it is. And then we looked at ways in which affection is, how affection can cease to be a demon, how the positive sides of affection and how it bonds us to the people with whom we spend the most of our time, how it helps us notice the quirky things about them, and instead of making those quirky things drive us crazy, they endear them to us, and we grow in affection towards them, and as Christ loves the unlovable, we can start to appreciate the things about each other that could drive us crazy, but could also make us go, oh, man, yeah, I really like that guy. But we also talked about how love begins to be a demon the moment he begins to be a god. And if that neediness, that need love, is turned away from our need from God and we're focusing for that need in each other instead of putting God first, how that love and affection can become a demon. And we looked at a couple of different ways for that. One way is that we assume that affection is a right, that it's something that we should have and we shouldn't have to work for it and care for the people around us and have just general human decency. We can say what we want around our family members and we should get affection in return, and that's not the case. It's reasonable to expect affection, but it's not a right that we have. It's also very easy to get jealous of the affections when they turn to something else and you maybe aren't in with the same interests. And so people get pulled apart that way. Affection's also a type of gift love. We know as parents, as siblings, you know, you give that affection to someone. But also it's affection that you want them to want. And if you're so focused on giving your affection to someone and that is where your focus is instead of giving it to God, that can turn into keeping your objects that you actually love really needy and dependent. True affection should be you're wanting the best for the people that you love, and that might turn into them being independent and no longer needy of you. So keeping the object of your love in need and under, for lack of a better word, control, that's where affection can go bad. So I want to read a little quote from page 71. It's G. for you in your outline. It says, affection produces happiness if and only if there is common sense and give and take and decency. In other words, only if something more and other than affection is added. The mere feeling is not enough. You need common sense, that is reason. You need give and take, that is you need justice, continually stimulating mere affection when it fades and restraining it when it forgets or would defy the art of love. You need decency. There is no disguising the fact that this means goodness, patience, self-denial, humility, and the continual intervention of a far higher sort of love than affection in itself can ever be. That is the whole point. If we try to live by affection alone, affection will go bad on us. And I hope that list of qualities there is reminding you of 1 Corinthians, some of those same descriptions of what love is. And often love from 1 Corinthians is treated as storge, but it's actually the word agape, which we'll get to in 2 weeks and talk a little bit more about that word and 1 Corinthians then. So that's a little bit of a recap from last week about the elements of love, this idea of likeness, but not necessarily us being like God and made in his image, bringing us closer to him, as well as the ideas of the highest cannot stand without the lowest, and when love ceases to be a demon, it becomes a god, and vice versa. So I'm going to jump into philia, which is friendship, and I neglected also last week to...
In Greek, whoops, they have...
...tell you where this came from. So there's actually a YouTube channel called C.S. Lewis Doodles, and they have a great body of his work. So it's not just the four loves. It's quite a bit. It's wonderful. But this is the only recording of his actual voice, so it's not him reading the other ones. It's other performers who happen to be reading it. He just happened to do the broadcast, and it happened to survive over time. And let me now go back and find.
To begin, we men of God, GE, means affection, the sort of love there ought to be between near relations. Philia, P-H-I-L-I-A, means friendship. Eros, E-R-O-S, is of course the love between the sexes. And agape, A-G-A-P-E, is love in the Christian sense, God's love for man and the Christian's love for the brethren. I want to talk about philia, or friendship. In our age, it's much harder to talk about this than about storge and eros. When those are your theme, you find a prepared audience. Their importance and beauty and value have been stressed and indeed exaggerated again and again. But very few modern people think friendship a relation of comparable importance. We readily admit that besides a wife and family, a man wants a few friends. But the very tone of the admission, the very meaning it gives to the word friends, make it clear that friendship is very far from being regarded as a main course in life's banquet, or even a course at all. It's more like the bread you crumble almost unconsciously during a long dinner. It's one of the etc. Why this has happened is well worth inquiry. The first and most obvious answer is that most people don't think about it because a great many people don't experience it. It's hard to get through life without encountering some kind and degree of both eros and storge. And of course it's impossible that life should go on unless many people felt both, because without eros none of us would be begotten, and without storge none of us would be reared. The peculiarity of friendship is that it's not unavoidable. Thousands of people have lived and died without knowing it. To be sure, 900 of each 1,000 will have had what we commonly call friends, people they drink with and play games with and chat with and cooperate with, perhaps amicably enough in their profession. But this useful and pleasant relationship is not of itself what I mean by friendship. There's lately arisen, too, a much nastier bit of evidence to show that the experience of philia is not universal. I mean, of course, the fact that if you speak of it with any seriousness, you are now quite likely to be suspected of homosexuality. This is extremely revealing. It doesn't at all prove that those who bring the charge are homosexual themselves. Nor would I moralize upon them if they were. How a man can feel anything but bewildered pity for the genuinely homosexual, I've never been able to understand. What it does prove is that they have either never known friendship or never known eros. For I appeal to everyone who's known both to bear me witness that in some ways nothing is so unlike a friendship as a love affair. Lovers talk incessantly about their love, friends hardly ever about their friendship. Lovers talk incessantly to one another about one another, friends about anything rather than that. The characteristic posture of lovers is face to face, that of friends side by side. Admittedly, friendship between man and woman can turn into love, but the very fact that we can speak of turning into implies the difference. Of course, it's not...
Right. So I think that's a nice introduction to distinguishing philia from eros. And I know we're going to get into eros next week, but I think this, the image of them, the husband and wife or lovers face to face, their focus is on each other. And then friends are, why would we talk about each other? I don't understand. So I really like the idea of side by side and a little bit, I like this pointing and looking forward to some kind of goal. And the part of philia that's often quoted by or of Lewis is he asked the question, what, you two? I thought I was the only one. And it's that realization, that moment when you might have spent some time with a group of people that you have something in common with, but then you find that person that thinks about something in a similar way that you do. And we all find ourselves here in this room because we're all seeking for a similar truth. We're all here because we have the commonality of being Christians. And I think that's a wonderful place for us to start. But the next part that I'm going to go into is Lewis's distinction between companionship, camaraderie, allegiances, and then that of the special relationship of friendship. And there's going to be three different parts to it. But one thing that doesn't show up in here that I think is really important to say is that, yes, friends, when they find each other, may have this common outlook or common insight or common goal or common question that they are concerning themselves with. But in the book, he's really particular to point out that just because you're both thinking about it doesn't mean you have to agree on it. And so friends have this friendship, and they're asking these questions of each other, and they're spending time with one another, but it's not necessarily in complete agreement on that conversation or issue or topic that they're thinking about. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about a true friendship. And I think about Ginsburg and Scalia, who were completely on opposite ends of thoughts and their interpretations of how the law should be presented, but their friendship was such a good, strong friendship, and it's a good model for everyone. But I'm going to jump ahead to where he's talking about companionship and then how that can then morph into a good friendship. Oh, no, I lied. I'm going to go... I'm going to get to that in a minute. First, though, he's going to talk about some more characteristics that make philia interesting and separate from storge and eros. So that was a little bit about eros. The next is going to be a little bit about storge, because we just naturally fall into storge. I mean, our families are our first unit that kind of get us outside of ourselves, and we start to feel affection for them. But what's interesting about philia is, like he said, you can go through your whole life and never actually experience it. And so it's not necessarily something that's instinctive and natural and is part of our biological makeup like eros and storge may be. So I'm going to jump to that, and then after that, we'll jump to companionship.
One fact. The fact that philia is, in one sense, the least natural of the loves. It has least commerce with our nervous system. There's nothing throaty about it, nothing that quickens the pulse or makes you red or pale. It's not, in its full development, a biological necessity. The individual can live and breed and protect himself without it. Eros and storge are too obviously connected with the body, too widely shared with the beasts, too closely linked with biological necessity. In them, one could almost feel that nature pulls the strings and we are the puppets. In philia, on the other hand, we have the feeling, whether illusory or not, of being free from all that. Hence, friendship alone of all the loves seemed to our ancestors to raise us to the level of gods or angels. Thus, some men have exalted and others have depreciated or denied the love called philia for exactly the same reason. Because in it, man seems furthest removed from the animal, from the irrational, and from necessity. This does not seem to me a good ground either for praising it or disparaging it. For, as I said before, nothing in man is either better or worse because he shares it with the beasts. Nor does anything need to be justified by its survival value. The things which make survival worth having are not to be rated below the things which enable us to survive. If everything that's not harnessed to the biological wagon is to be called perversion, then we must say, as I said before, that humanity itself, and the more human the more so, is the greatest perversion of all.
All right, I'll stop it right there. So that's a little bit of his insight into how he distinguishes philia from those other close relationships that we may have. It's not something that will just naturally happen to us. We're born into a family. We tend to, most people have at least some kind of attraction to someone, whether that is given back to us or not in the form of eros. But friendship, we can go through our whole lives and not experience it. So then how do we become friends? Starts with companionship. So I'll scoot to that.
Necessary. And perhaps of all relationships, camaraderie produces the fewest pains and the most pleasures, often wholly innocent and recreative pleasures. A life without it would be crippled. And for my own part, I have the deepest suspicions of those wretched people who find no pleasure in the society of their own sex. Heaven protect me from the man who needs only women and the woman who needs only men. But at the same time, we must insist that friendship is not simply camaraderie or companionship. Those who don't experience friendship or philia proper think that friend means only comrade or companion, one with whom we can collaborate easily or spend our leisure agreeably. But those who know philia make a distinction. Among their 100 or so comrades, only 5 or 6 may be in the true sense friends. Of course, in ordinary conversation, they apply the word friends to the whole 100. But that is a façon de parler, a polite fiction, like the adjective dear at the beginning of a letter.
Right. So I hope that this is having you start to think about your best friends. And if you're fortunate, like I am, I married mine. And he was part of my, you know, out of the couple hundred people I went to high school and middle school and elementary school with, he was in my group of 5 or so. And then I hit 12 and went, ooh, that guy I think is my guy. And then we had a bit of a 9-year break. And he's not here, so I can talk about him. But and then, you know, after 9 years and, you know, I'm no longer 12, which is, you know, for the best. And that's when, you know, it moved into that he's my one person. But he was certainly one of my 5 or 6 out of the hundreds of people with whom I spent the most time. Would anyone like to share about their best friend? He's Stephen's mine, so it's kind of a cheat. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's, yeah, you don't talk about your friendships. Yeah, that's wonderful. I like the image of cradle to grave and how your grandmothers and perhaps their friendship was instrumental in your friendship. Would anyone else like to share?
Required right now, like this season of life, to be almost with kids and stuff. So for me, it's the necessity of frequency doesn't dictate the depth of the friendship.
And these are exact qualities that Lewis is going to be pointing out for us. It's not bound by time and place and age. You find your people and you just connect in a way that's unique and special. And there might be lots of other people around you. They don't have that same degree of connection. So I'm going to jump forward. There's 2 more clips about this idea of companionship and then becoming friendship.
The difference between mere companionship and friendship depends on the nature of the shared activity. The men of the tribe sit talking together because they are all hunters and warriors. Take the individuals apart, place them for a few years in different cultures, using different techniques, facing different problems, and then reassemble them. I very much doubt if the old companionship, the old club, would come to life again. For the bond of union lay in their functions, not in the personalities of each. But if in that prehistoric club, there had been 2 who went sometimes apart to talk of something which the rest had no bent for, 2 who were groping their way towards the beginnings of art or philosophy or religion, then I should expect that those 2, at such a reunion as I'm imagining, would resume their old relationship. They are linked together not as warriors or trappers, but as men, as the very 2 men they were and are. The activity they shared, they always will share as long as they are the same men. As Montaigne says, a man is my friend because he is he, because I am I. Whereas a man is my comrade because he is my colleague or neighbor or ally. But does not Eros, does not the love between man and woman also say, because she is she, because I am I? Certainly, but Eros doesn't mean quite the same thing. Eros means because she is my goal, my journey's end, my quarry, because I need her and she me, because we are key and lock, thirst and water, seal and wax. But friendship means because he has the same goal, because he is taking the same journey, because he is hunting the same quarry, because we are both filled with the same need. I am speaking, of course, of Eros here in a sort of chemical.
So there is some of those ideas that were just presented in our two examples of friendship. It doesn't matter if you're separated by time. Maybe you met because you were linked by activity, but because the two of you found something in each other, your friendship will be sustainable even after you part. So the part that I'm skipping over, if you're interested in going back and looking at it, is the part that talks about friendships between men and women and how culturally when it's possible and not possible.
Influential. Friendship is a development from mere companionship or camaraderie. It could indeed be defined as companionship transferred to a deeper level. Transferred to those desires, fears, hopes, or delights which make us the precise people we are. Hence, the very first step in friendship is not a movement of liking towards another man. That is the second step. First comes the shared activity. To care about something other than friends, even if it were only a hobby, is the precondition of friendship. If you're going nowhere, you can have no traveling companions. If you've nothing to share, you can share nothing. Friendships always come, if they come at all, unasked, unsought, as Keble said. Friends don't talk much about one another, nor about their friendship. On the eve of a long parting, in danger, in sorrow, they may express the deep love and unshakable loyalty that's between them. The very rarity of such explicitness may even make it especially poignant. But friendship would lose its essential character if they were frequent. The fact that friendship is thus normally unexpressed and merely implicit helps to conceal from some observers the truth that it's a form of love at all. It is manifest far more in its results than in any direct emotional impact, as a man's love of God is better gauged by the tenor of his whole life than by his moments of what the theologians call sensible consolation. This comes up.
So that's a little bit about how we get to be from mere companions into actually being friends. So there are a couple more things that I want to talk about in terms of what philia is like. So we've got that it's the least natural of the loves. So therefore it's the least natural, it's getting closer to being more spiritual. And so the next little bit's going to go into a little bit of Lewis talking about what he means by it being more spiritual. That doesn't mean it's more holy. It's actually not more holy just because it's more spiritual. And it doesn't mean that it doesn't err, because it does. Because going back to the idea of love becoming a demon, depending on how we treat it, and if we're focusing too much on one type of love, we'll lose track of who we should be putting our love in first.
Again, the seriousness and importance of friendship is masked for some people by a characteristic which is really its glory. It is unnecessary. It is arbitrary, a thing of choice. We are no way obliged to make any man a friend, and we have no claim that any man should become ours. It is more nearly disinterested than any other love. Friends may be useful and may increase our happiness. But it's impossible to make them our friends with this in view. In a word, it's free. And with this freedom goes a certain noble irresponsibility. I hope the word won't be misunderstood. Of course, we have responsibilities to every man. Every man is his brother's keeper. And if to leave any man unhelped or uncomforted when help and comfort are in our power is bad, so to leave a friend is worse. But such good offices are not the stuff of friendship. They're a byproduct. The mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given, of course it will, when the pinch comes, but that having been given, it makes no difference at all. It was an anomaly, a distraction. It had interrupted the conversation. For, of course, friends don't want to know one another's affairs at all. You can become friends with a man before you know whether he's married or single or how he earns his living. In a circle of true friends, each man stands for nothing but what he is. No one cares about anyone else's family or professional status or class or regional origin or nationality or previous history. In fact, all the things biographers want to know, they care nothing about. In time, of course, all these things will be revealed, but not for their own sake. They will come in accidentally. That is the delight of philia, the contact of stripped or disentangled souls. For eros, naked bodies. For friendship, naked personalities. You'll notice that I've passed inevitably from speaking of a pair of friends to speaking of a group. Two is not, in fact, the perfect number for friendship. Hence, though jealousy can creep in here, as where not, friendship is by nature the least jealous of all loves. Two friends will be glad to be joined by a third, and three by a fourth. When two or three or five of us, after a hard day's walking, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on and our feet spread out towards the blaze, and our drinks are at our elbows, and the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for any of the others, but all freemen and equals, as if we just met half an hour ago, while nonetheless an affection mellowed by the years is there and fills up the chinks, then we may well wonder whether on the natural level there is anything better than this. And of course, in a sense, nothing is. Nothing is ever better than what's best in its own kind. The greatest wine cannot be better than a slice of perfectly good bread. It's no wonder, then, that past ages thought friendship the crown of life. It is the least jealous, the least demanding of loves, almost free from self-interest, immune from the internal corruptions of storge. It can, as the ancients thought, be a school of virtue. If men are good at all, they become better by mutual friendship. Each lives up to all the rest. We could easily be tempted to regard it, not merely as an analogy to, but a real foretaste of the heavenly unity.
So this idea of getting together with a group of just really good friends and you're by the hearth, and we've heard Nate's sermons about the hearth and the meaning of that for us as families and as Christians, but that sense of being together, C.S. Lewis is putting that against the image of us in heaven together and how that kind of closeness that you feel is how he feels heaven might be for him. And so getting too bogged down in the friendship and the spirituality that could come along with friendship, you can get away from what's truly holy and make that friendship your main love. And so now we're going to get into how philia, just like storge, can be ambivalent. It can work for good, it can work for bad. The way he says this is friendship can be a school of virtue, but also a school of vice. It makes good men better and bad men worse. And this brought to mind, for me, Proverbs 27:17, iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. And so now we're going to get into a little bit of the downsides of friendship and how we need to be careful in our friendships, because they do sharpen us and they do influence us. And some of the main ways that they do that, that he's going to go over, is you can get really lost in your friendships and just flat out ignore the opinions of others and not really see how your actions are impacting a broader group. You can also think then your opinions are more superior because you have a group of people around you who are constantly agreeing with you or thinking in a like-minded way as you, and you can become indifferent. It also might cause some envy from people on the outside of your friendship group. And then also there's a bit of pride that comes along with that. And this goes to the appreciative love piece of when you have a friend and they're such a good person in your life, you think, wow, I can't believe this awesome person is friends with me. And so it gives you this sense of personal humility, but then at the same time, it gives you this sense of, man, I'm part of this awesome group. Aren't we as a group great? And so you get the sense of corporate pride is how he refers to it, and the sense of superiority. So therefore, if you're superior, then there must be somebody and some opinions that are less than yours. And he kind of talks about two different types of corporate pride. Olympian, where in the South we would say, oh, bless his heart. Like, he just doesn't understand where we're coming from. And then there's also the Titanic corporate pride, which can be restive and militant and embittered and can cause a lot of negativity to be existing. So I'm actually going to move forward, and we're going to watch the last 5 minutes, which is perfect.
By its spirituality, friendship escapes some of the obvious dangers of the other loves. Its danger lies precisely in its spirituality. Consider how a circle of friends, such as I've been describing, appears from outside. Almost every name given to it is in some degree unpleasant. It's a set, a coterie, a gang, a mutual admiration society. To belong to a group of real friends is to be armed, in a degree which friendless men can't imagine, against influences from without. The public opinion within the group may be tiny, but it matters more than the opinion of 10,000 outsiders. The approval of those whom we love and honor is the approval we value. Every knot of friends is thus a resistance movement. And, of course, the external pressures which it arms us to resist may be good ones or bad ones. In it we may retreat into something better or worse than the public world. It may be a nursery of martyrs or of criminals. In real life, friendship can unite by what is still good in them, men otherwise very bad, and thus fortify them in evil. There can, for example, be an aristocratic caste, very cruel and unjust to the rest of the world, but quite genuinely united within by friendships, mutual loves, honor, and courtesy. The more real and even lofty the friendship within such a caste is, the more it may steel their nerves and stop their ears to all claims from without. The same man who would die for his brother in arms might not deny himself one bottle of wine or one game of cards to save a village of peasants from massacre. The sufferings and the moral judgments of outsiders don't affect him. It's the approval of his friends that matters. Friendship, as we've seen, is based on sharing at depth of activities and attitudes, a relation between souls side by side. The things shared may be good or bad or mixed. Friendship doesn't transform them. It raises them, for good or ill, to a higher power and gives them more confidence. It makes brave men braver, kind men kinder, pious men more pious, cruel men more cruel, proud men more proud. It underlines, endorses, sanctions, defends either from true or from false shame whatever they were doing already. If you and I want to evade some dangerous duty, the best plan is to find two or three other cowards and do our shirking in company. It's wonderful how little discomfort you'll feel when we've talked it all over and laughed it all over together. Equally, if we have to stand out against a real evil, to risk embarrassment and jeers and the possible loss of a job, the best plan is to get together with two or three other honest men. The ordeal will become amazingly less formidable. Friends, in a word, give us moral support or immoral support. I've glanced at extreme examples, but they're extremes of a moral ambivalence which is inherent in friendship. It can be a school of individual humility, but with this individual humility, how easily there comes a corporate pride. I may be unworthy, but we, the set, are magnificent. Loyalty to the spirit of a noble circle, adherence to its standards, has so often proved for us the road to goodness that we may come to mistake it for goodness itself. To stand by our friends, to stick to the firm, to go down with the ship, these things being almost absolutes, may become absolutes. Aucassin in the story said he would rather go to hell with the knights and ladies and troubadours than to heaven with the hermits. Now, a man must be very good or, and that's the trouble, very bad, not to feel in himself a response to that gesture. A kind of heroic loyalty is often mixed with that corporate impenitence which binds bad men together in their last stand. Friendship is a resistance movement. It can resist God as well as society. And yet all the time by a kind of goodness or what had been goodness in it. Friendship is the most spiritual loves, and therefore its corruption the most spiritual corruption. A certain kind of mother may be like a man-eating tigress, a certain kind of lover like a rutting animal. Storge and Eros can fall by animality. But friendship gone wrong liberates not the animal in man, but the titanic or diabolical. It is high-minded. It can have proud looks. By its nature, it must and should defy popular opinion. It may go on to defy mercy and justice and God himself. This love, too, can breed unlove. Nothing, not even friendship, is good except goodness.
So one of the interesting things about how God is referred to in the Bible, he's referred to as our Father, which, oh, thanks, which evokes storge. And then and also Christ is referred to often as the bridegroom of the church, which evokes Eros. But we don't, sorry, I don't know where the controller is for that. If it's okay with you, I'll just keep talking. And so God the Father evokes storge. Christ, the bridegroom of the church, evokes Eros. But we don't usually have this sense of the representation of God the friend. Jesus does talk about his disciples as his friends, and there's quite a few Bible verses that reference brotherly love. But this is what Lewis says about referring to Christ or God in terms of friendship. Perhaps we may now hazard a guess why Scripture uses friendship so rarely as an image of the highest love. It is already an actual fact too spiritual to be a good symbol of spiritual things. The highest does not stand without the lowest. God can safely represent himself to us as father and husband because only a lunatic would think that he is physically our sire or that his marriage with the church is other than mystical. But if friendship were used for this purpose, we might mistake the symbol for the things symbolized. The danger inherent in it would be aggravated. We might be further encouraged to mistake that nearness by resemblance to the heavenly life, which is friendship, certainly displays for a nearness of approach. And friendship can be used as an imitation of what that highest love can be. And there's quite a few Bible verses, and I listed them for you at the end, of where the word, and I don't know any Hebrew, but ahab, which means brotherly love, shows up in the friendship between Jonathan and David. Jonathan was Saul's son and was meant to be the heir apparent, but David came in and became king, but Jonathan loved him. And then also in Proverbs 17:17, Ahab is used as well. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Philadelphia is used quite a few times, and there's in 1 Peter 1:22, 2 Peter 1:5-7, and 1 Thessalonians 4:9-10. I'm just going to read those three, and then we'll end there, because they happen to be three verses that use philia in the form of Philadelphia, but in the exact same verse, they also use agape. So in 1 Peter, it says, having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for insincere brotherly love, philia, love, agape, one another earnestly from a pure heart. So this is the highest standing, highest cannot stand without the lowest. So we're starting the sense of brotherly love, but we're getting to agape. In 2 Peter 1, 5-7 says, for this reason, make every effort to supplement your faith with virtue, and virtue with knowledge, and knowledge with self-control, and self-control with steadfastness, and steadfastness with godliness, and godliness with brotherly affection, or philia, and brotherly affection with agape, love. And then 1 Thessalonians 4:9, 10 says, now concerning brotherly love, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves have been taught by God to love, agape, one another. For that indeed is what you are doing to all the brothers throughout Macedonia. But we urge you, brothers, do this more and more. So there's quite a few instances in the Bible where the love that's being experienced among the Christians is this sense of brotherly love and philia. But with the addition of Christ in their lives, it's moving to agape. And that's where I'll end for today. And I hope I see you next week for Eris. Thank you. Oh, I didn't pray. Bow your heads with me while I pray really quickly. Lord God, we gather together today to learn about friendship. You are the truth that has brought us together. You are the goal that is uniting us, that is linking us through the Holy Spirit to Christians around the world. Help us to form the bonds of friendship in your name that will lead us towards the greater sense of decency, compassion, patience, fortitude, and belief. As we are scattered into the world this week, help us to be the type of men and women that sharpen others to not only be more like you, but to also approach you and know you better. Thank you for the gift of the Holy Spirit and the friends that sharpen us and hone our lives to be a straight and narrow path leading us towards your Son, Jesus, in whose name we pray.